This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Shutdowns, it seems, can make the corporate heart grow fonder. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 16th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Day 26 is where we find ourselves. No signs of relief in the offing. And so as happens when you go without something for a while, a certain wistfulness has come over some parts of corporate America, a longing, if you will, for a little good old-fashioned government bureaucracy. Because while it may slow things down, without it, it is tough to get anything done. From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
Justin Cox is suing the federal government because he can't sell his beer.
Specifically, our spring seasonal beer, the precious one, which is an apricot IPA.
Cox is CEO of Atlas Brew Works, a craft brewery here in D.C. The company is stuck in a holding pattern because the agency that would approve the new label for the precious one is shut down.
We're in this precarious position now. We have beer sitting in our tank that we don't have a place to put it into the market without this label.
Bridget Dooling is with the George Washington Regulatory Studies Center.
I mean, it's hard enough to run a small business, but when you're waiting for someone else to make a decision, those are hours and days and maybe even weeks when you're not able to proceed.
She says lots of industries could use a little more government decision-making right now. Drug makers can't bring new products to market, automakers are waiting for emission sign-offs, and that label issue comes up for the meat industry, too.
In order to have make a label change of meat and poultry, you have to go to USDA and actually have that label change approved.
Many federal food inspections aren't happening, but Richard Williams, who spent almost three decades in food safety at the FDA, says we shouldn't worry too much.
The incentives for a food manufacturer to keep his food safe are pretty strong in this country. No one wants to be at the receiving end of a recall.
Even if the recall happens after the shutdown is over, whenever that might be. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to keep her job, at least for now. She won by the most slender of margins a no-confidence vote in Parliament today. Whether she's happy about that or not is tough to know because she still has Brexit smack in her lap. Will it still happen after yesterday's parliamentary torpedoing of the deal that May negotiated with the EU? Not sure. When? Don't know. Are all the possibilities, known in the vernacular as a hard Brexit, a soft Brexit, or no Brexit, still out there? Yeah, I guess. A common sense observer would say all of this uncertainty should be taking a toll on global markets and the wider economy, right? We'll see. Here's Scott Tong.
Key markets gave a rather ho-hum reaction to yesterday's no vote on the British government's Brexit plan. London stocks rose a bit, the pound gave up a tad, because many investors predict the UK is moving to a softer divorce from Europe, or none at all. In other words, a win for economic connectedness. Jonathan Portis teaches economics at King's College in London.
Compared to the US-China trade war, Brexit is actually pretty small beer. Nonetheless, it might be perhaps a signal of a swing back against populism and protectionism.
But they could be wrong. Political indecision could lead to a chaotic Brexit in March, goods piling up at the British border, grounded planes, European economic pain. Many companies want to stock extra parts and inventory just in case of shortages. But today's global supply chains don't always allow for that, says economist Peter Holmes at the University of Sussex. He spoke by Skype.
The whole essence of the just-in-time systems is you don't have spare capability to do that. The food industry simply can't, you know, expand refrigerated warehouses because there aren't any.
Brexit uncertainty adds to a global laundry list of question marks: U.S.-China trade, Iran oil sanctions, North Korea. But Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, says none of these are immediate crises yet.
I think the markets will say, well, yeah, there's nothing really to worry about because we don't have these problems, but we're not resolving any of them.
He says when the next real crisis comes, the global economic pain could be big. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Today's Man Bites Economic Dog Dog story comes to us from Sears and the federal bankruptcy code. The man who drove Sears into bankruptcy just made a deal to buy Sears in a bankruptcy auction. The retailer's once, and I guess future, CEO Eddie Lampert is going to pay just over $5 billion for the company he used to own. The deal does still have to be approved by a judge, we should say that. But as we have reported on this program, Sears has been struggling for a long time. So why exactly does Lampert want to pour more money into it? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
When a company files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, there are a couple ways things can go. It can reemerge with a plan to pay back its creditors, the banks and businesses it owes money to, or it can liquidate.
You're broken up and sold in pieces, and the creditors are repaid in some shape or fashion.
Robert Rostin is principal at Training the Street. Most of Sears' creditors want the company to liquidate, but a liquidation would be real bad for Eddie Lampert.
He could have lost quite a bit of money.
Because Lampert and his hedge fund, ESL Investments, are Sears' largest creditors. They've lent Sears more than $1 billion, and in a liquidation, that could get wiped out. Lampert and his hedge fund are also the retailer's biggest shareholders.
And as an equity investor, there's a good chance that you're not going to get anything back. The equity investors are only paid if the creditors are paid.
So Lampert is making this bid to keep Sears alive. At least that way, the company can still generate cash. For instance, years ago, a real estate firm Lampert owns bought hundreds of Sears stores. Merlo Campello teaches finance at Cornell.
There could be some cash flows that can be extracted, such as the payment of the rent that goes to his pocket.
Lampert negotiated one other benefit for himself in this deal. It would protect him from lawsuits by creditors who accuse him of stripping Sears of assets. Representatives for Lampert declined to comment for this story. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, you can take your government shutdown and you can take your Brexit and your slowing Chinese economy, and you know what you can do with them. Well, what you can do with them is you can stack them up against corporate profits, and that'll explain why the major indices were up today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a special section of the Detroit Auto Show, which is more properly the North American International Auto Show, which is in full swing this week, that's all about the car of the future. Fully self-driving, more experiential than, ooh, I don't know, a minivan you schlep the kids and the groceries back and forth in. And while those kinds of cars are still a ways away from showing up at your local dealership, partially autonomous cars are on the roads right now, loaded with things like beeping alerts to let you know if there's a car in your blind spot or steering wheels that vibrate when you drift into another lane. It's cool, and it can save lives, but as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports, drivers might be relying on that stuff just a bit too much.
Turn on your TV these days, and you could be forgiven for thinking the self-driving car is already here.
The ability to make 1,000 decisions before you even make one.
With the confidence of Ford Copilot 360 technology. Nissan ProPilot Assist. With the push of a button, the line between man and machine was blurred.
With Pilot in the brand names and ads showing drivers releasing the steering wheel as their cars keep them from drifting, even savvy drivers can overestimate the capabilities of their advanced safety features. 57-year-old Scott Berg bought his Volkswagen Atlas a couple years ago, in part for the tech.
Yeah, so this is my favorite part. This is what's so great about this car.
We're on a freeway north of Los Angeles when he pushes a button on his steering wheel and then takes his foot off the pedals.
Adaptive cruise. I'm going to get behind this guy, and I'm going to tell the car that I want it to go 80.
It starts to accelerate, and we're creeping up on the car ahead of us. As we get close, he's still not touching the pedals, but the car slows down.
He pretty much set it and forget it.
Almost. Berg explains the sensors can detect moving cars, but can't read tight turns or suddenly stopped vehicles. I mentioned they can also get jammed by mud or snow.
I did not know that, and it makes me glad that I live in L.A.
Now, Berg's researched the vehicle, even flipped through the owner's manual, but he still has knowledge gaps about his car's advanced features. A recent AAA study found he's like a lot of people. 4 out of 5 drivers didn't know their blind spot detectors can miss pedestrians or vehicles at certain speeds. 1/4 said they no longer always check their blind spots.
If that's the attitude, then it's only a matter of time before you get in an accident.
UC Irvine vehicle technology researcher Hillary Abraham doesn't blame drivers for their misconceptions. Most people look to their car salesman to explain their high-tech features. But she says they don't always have the answers.
The onus is really being placed on the consumer to find information, but it's really difficult to find.
First, drivers have to sort through all the jargon. Advanced cruise control on one car is active cruise control on another, or intelligent cruise control, or Distronic Plus.
Automatic emergency braking has over 40 different names.
And Alex Epstein at the nonprofit National Safety Council says each one works differently.
Some don't stop you. Some just slow you down. Some can't see pedestrians. Others can. And the problem is there's no common nomenclature out there. There is no commonality.
He says many drivers deactivate the features because they don't understand them and find them annoying. Automakers acknowledge the confusion. Andy Christensen works on advanced safety features for Nissan. He says automakers shouldn't try to explain all the complex limitations. Instead, customers need to keep in mind one guiding rule.
These technologies aren't driving for them. They are still driving. They are still in full control. These systems are just helping in the background.
The National Safety Council thinks drivers should know the individual limitations. To explain them, the council's launched a website and a smartphone game of all things. But Epstein says there's only one real solution to educating drivers.
Education needs to be done by the automakers in the vehicle, because every system is different.
Because if even the smartphone game can come with a tutorial when you first open it, why can't a car? In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
We did some reporting earlier this week about retail over the holidays, who did well and who did less well. Macy's and JCPenney are firmly in that latter category, but it got us thinking this morning about Alana Furco. She manages the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. We talk to her every now and then. Conversations that turn not infrequently to the retail apocalypse that's been happening in the past couple of years. She even lost her own JCPenney at the Butte Plaza Mall, which is where we got her on the phone today. Hey, Alana, it's Kai. How are you?
Happy New Year, Kai.
Happy New Year to you, too. Thanks for taking the time to call us. I understand you had a nosebleed situation there, so I appreciate this.
Well, yeah, there's walking program today, and, you know, they come in from the cold, they start walking. Yeah, so had to just pass off some tissue. Everything's good. Everything's good.
So the walking program is just people walking around the mall?
Yes, yeah. Our local community health, she has organized a program. They used to walk outside but then things got a little smoky. So that drove them into the mall, and they have enjoyed it so much, they have coordinated their walking program inside.
Well, that's good, because, you know, you're getting people in the mall. And look, that's why we're calling, right? To find out what life is like in the Butte Plaza Mall these days.
Things are better.
Well, that's good, because honestly, last time we spoke, it was maybe not so good. First of all, how were the holidays for y'all?
The holidays were strong. People were just wonderful. They shopped local. They shopped small. They shopped strong.
Huh.
There really seemed to be a commitment to that this year.
That's great. So small dollar purchases, but a lot of them.
A lot of them,
huh.
Yes. It was just very joyful and very supportive.
Well, that's good. One of the things that kind of bummed me out last time we spoke was that one of your anchor stores was closing, and you had, I think it was a hotel nearby using one of your big stores as like storage space, right?
Right. They were doing a remodel.
Yeah.
So they were staging all of the new furniture here and then moving it to the hotel as they emptied the rooms.
But now you have filled that space with a tenant. Do I have that right?
We have leased that space, yes.
Talk to me about that.
So they actually are a call center business. They provide support for about 70 clients. It is a call-in center, not telemarketing.
Uh-huh.
So they won't be calling you and harassing you.
Okay, that's good.
These
to
are
know.
The people you want to talk to.
Yeah. I was thinking before we got on the phone today that really your job as the manager of that mall is basically to keep the square footage rented, right? And it doesn't much matter, really, whether it's a big department store maybe or a call center.
You know, we've talked about this. Sustainability of exclusive retail properties
right.
really needed to be looked at. Properties who have embraced mixed use concepts. That's the direction that's going to be our reboot.
Right.
But, you know, if we can bring up to 300 people, that's definitely going to bring some life back to this block.
Yeah, so that's 300 jobs. That's what you mean, right?
Yes. We couldn't have asked for a better Happy New Year.
Now, talk to me about the rest of the mall. How are not the big anchor properties, but some of the smaller retail spaces through that mall doing?
You know, things have still been tough. We closed our Payless shoe store.
Yeah,
and our manager, she's been with the company 34 years, a personal friend of mine. That was really hard. You know, if there's one thing that retailers do is we adapt. If you don't adapt, you'll go the way of the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know things are going to pick up.
Alana Furco, she's the manager at the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Alana, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care, Kai.
Coming up.
All of my nervous energy. I do remember running around the house cleaning everything.
Got to keep your mind off the shutdown somehow, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 141 points today, about 0.5%, 24,207. The NASDAQ picked up 10 points, 0.1%, 7,034. S&P 500 advanced 5 points, about 0.2%, 26,016. We heard from Marielle about Eddie Lampert's bid to save what's left of Sears. Sears shares surged 55.55%, the double nickel. Elsewhere in retail, Walmart gained 0.1%. Macy's down 2% today. Ford is forecasting softer than expected fourth quarter earnings. Ford says it's not going to be offering any kind of full forecast for the full year. Shares down 6% today. Just yesterday, Ford announced a manufacturing alliance with Volkswagen. Volkswagen down 0.1% in overseas trading. GM up 0.3%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.72%. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We talk with some degree of regularity about bonds on this program. Government bonds, first of all, and their oh-so-important interest rates. Also, though, corporate bonds, debt that companies issue to borrow money to expand and invest. But not all debt is created equal. There are bonds that are super safe, and there are bonds that are less safe but more remunerative. And that slice of the corporate bond world has been showing some signs of trouble. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Corporate bonds are graded by the ratings agencies. Ratings like A, AA, BBB. Karen Rothman is at John Hancock Asset Management.
The credit rating comes from the perceived risk of default.
Bonds that score low are considered junk. The formal phrase is high yield. And this is not an insult. It's a wager. Higher return, higher risk of default. Rothman says junk bonds are common for companies that tend to carry a lot of debt.
A good number of high-yield bonds are issued by energy companies. Other issuers in the market that are quite large are telecommunications companies, media and technology companies, and healthcare companies.
Sprint has been selling billions in junk bonds to help build its giant 5G network. Dell sold junk bonds to finance an acquisition in 2016. Junk bonds are part of a normal growing economy. But when there are signs the economy is slowing down,
that could mean that default rates in the corporate space will pick up.
That's Jeffrey Cleveland, chief economist at Payden & Riegel. He says that could explain why investors withdrew a record amount from junk bond funds last year. The volatile stock market isn't helping investors' appetite for risk either. Cleveland says junk bonds are a barometer for economic slowdowns.
The times when you see the worst performance in high yield are around the time of a recession. So if that's why money is leaving the space, then that is a more worrisome phenomenon.
Investors aren't the only ones shunning junk bonds. Companies haven't been issuing them because those high yields are expensive to pay out. There wasn't a single junk bond sale in December, but there are signs of a recovery in the junk bond market. For one, companies are selling them again this month. Putri Pasquale is managing director at PAMCO Prisma.
If they want to expand or they want to buy another company, at some point, some of those companies are going to be pushed by the realities of their business to come to the high-yield market.
But there are still concerns. Pasquale says right now, investors are more worried about companies like General Electric, giant beleaguered conglomerates whose corporate bonds haven't been given a junk rating yet.
The question with certain companies like GE, where they have a lot of debt on their balance sheet and their earnings, you know, are presumably on one trajectory, and that's downwards, they are at risk of becoming downgraded to high yield.
Right now, there's roughly $1 trillion of that kind of barely passing debt. If that debt gets downgraded, it would flood the junk bond market, making their values fall even lower and their yields even higher. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
President Trump signed the Government Employee Fair Treatment Act of 2019 into law today. Unintentional irony aside, think about it for a second. It guarantees federal employees that they are actually going to get paid whenever the shutdown finally ends. But there is a whole other group of people who are affected by this shutdown, and most, if not all of them, aren't going to be getting anything when they go back to work. Government contractors is who I'm talking about. People who do everything from computer programming to food service to you name it for the government. And that gets us to a special shutdown edition of our series, My Economy, stories of people and how they are making a go of it out there. This time, it's a retired government contractor near Washington, D.C.
I'm Janet Martin, and I'm a retired software engineer. Used to work in government contracting. I started somewhere in the late 80s, so it was about 25 years or so, worked for many, many different government contracting firms, little ones, big ones, all across the spectrum. The first shutdown I went through was the Newt Gingrich shutdown, which was before this one, the longest one ever. And I was very lucky. It was early on in my career, so I was not contributing a majority of income to the household. My husband had a good job at the time. It was just very stressful because I was home. I knew stuff was piling up. All I remember is I ended up cleaning my house. And with all of my nervous energy, I do remember running around the house cleaning everything. Some of the shutdowns were, we were very lucky. They were just like, you know, shuts down on Friday, opens back up by Monday. But some of them went on for a little while. Looking back on it, I realized that after that very first long shutdown that I was involved in, we always made sure we lived inside our paychecks. So, you know, we drive our cars till they literally fall apart in the driveway. We don't go on elaborate vacations. You know, we bought a house way back when, thinking eventually we would flip it for a bigger house. We've never done that. And it even affects me now, even though I'm retired. I still kind of keep the expenses down as much as I can. We don't go out and go crazy. As I was listening to all of this shutdown information, I realized that's part of the decisions I've made over the years, having this happen over and over and over again. You don't live at the level that maybe your paycheck would imply you could live, because you know that that paycheck's not, it may not be secure.
Can't do this series without your help, so hook us up and let us know how your economy is doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, in which I'm reasonably certain the Federal Reserve is just messing with it. The Fed's Beige Book came out today, the central bank's regularly scheduled regional report on the American economy divided by its 12 districts. What the Fed said was that most of the American economy is growing at a modest or moderate pace, which is fine, except we looked it up. Modest, according to Merriam-Webster's definition 4A, means limited in size, amount, or scope. Moderate, again, Merriam-Webster, definition number 5, means limited in scope or effect. I'm right, right? They're messing with us? And we are out of here. The Dow Industrial's up 141 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ picked up 10, that's a tenth percent. The S&P 500 advanced 5 points, about two-tenths of 1%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.